over to Sean.
All right. Well, thanks very much. Thanks, Bill, for inviting me to the session. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you. Joy, it's nice to see you here as well. I think one of the last times I saw Joy, she invited me to speak out at the Rural
Matters Conference.
Capturing Opportunities Conference, yeah, in Manitoba. And my talk followed a presentation by two candy kings of Winnipeg, the inventors of clodhoppers, and they spent their presentation time, throwing chocolate and candy at everyone, and then I got to stand up and talk about rural sustainability. So I was glad that neither Tom nor Garth showered you with chocolate. The title of our work here is From Crisis to Coherence, Lessons in Rural Policymaking in Canada. I've had the pleasure of working with Bill and Sarah Breen and Amanda Whiteman on this work, and we're part of a larger Canadian regional development project that's been going for about 4 years now. Bill and I are sitting on a mountain of information right now, so if at some point Bill interjects and says, "That's not right," we're at no point of coherence here, so we may end up just having some side conversation as we go along here. But the purpose of the paper has been to conduct a historical analysis going back even over 100 years of rural policymaking in Canada and look at those periods of continuity and then look at eras and periodic shifts that put us onto a new platform and a new era of continuity in rural policymaking. And what was it that caused the shift and what were the outcomes that followed? And the point to the title of Bill's session here is not just to sort of, oh, isn't that nice, isn't that interesting from a historical perspective, but really to try to extrapolate lessons from the past that we can apply onto the future. So I'll tell you a little bit about the project, but really try to jump right into these development eras and shifts and turn the conversation into the coherence and relevance of describing these eras and some of the policy implications. The Canadian Regional Development Project, really three basic objectives, the first of which was to try to understand to what extent new regionalism is evident in Canada, and I'll talk about what that means in just a moment, to identify and seek to understand whether there are particular innovations across the country in regional development, and then if so, how is that information being shared with other jurisdictions, and how are we learning from each other? For the new regionalist framework is a regional development approach, building on past regional development knowledge and really sort of what we've learned about the development processes over the last 30 or 40 years. Being both pushed and pulled into relevance. The push is coming from state restructuring and industrial restructuring that is really withdrawing resources and withdrawing the capacity of communities to interact with senior governments and their industrial partners. We've heard a lot about that, of course, over the last couple of days, driven by a neoliberal policy agenda and also tremendous amounts of industrial flexibility, something that we've been particularly keen on this conference. It's also being pulled into relevance in terms of when communities do actually work together within a region, there can be tremendous benefits of economic competitiveness. It brings some of the dynamics of social resilience into the development conversation. And the whole idea of new regionalism is really to engage in territorial planning. So rather than sort of saying, how are we going to make LNG work in this region, liquefied natural gas, let's look at this region as a development region and what types of element are actually appropriate to this place. LNG may be a component of that, but how do we put that into the mix of the assets and aspirations that exist within this territory to make it a successful development project? We've conducted case research in addition to sort of looking broadly across the literature. Worked in four provinces and five regions within those provinces, the Kootenays here in British Columbia, Eastern Ontario, Rimouski in Quebec, and the Northern Peninsula and Kitewake areas of Newfoundland to sort of really try to get into more detail of this phenomenon or not across the Canadian experience. So here's the framework that we've been working with as an analytical and policy framework. And Sarah made me promise not to change either the color or the feature of these explosions that they've been referring to them as we're trying to sort through this data. So here you have, before World War II, a period of nation building. and expansion, colonial expansion, the cataclysm of the Second World War being one of these sort of crisis or significant shift events, leading to a 30-odd year period of really interventionist policy around rural regional development, leading to the recession of the early 1980s, which was an extremely cataclysmic event for rural places, not only in British Columbia, across Canada, but in other industrialized nations around the world, which set us on a trajectory of about a 30-year process of restructuring, again, political and economic restructuring. The recession of 2009 has really, I think, forced a reconsideration of some of the policies that have taken place in that period. We've described that as a period of recognizing policy failure. And then, where are we going from here into the future? And we've called this era an era of negotiation. So I've blown the timeline a little bit here. It's not 2020. We're sort of into like 2040 and 2044. At the 2044 annual SURF conference, what are they going to be looking back over the last 30-year trajectory, and what are the lessons that we've learned, and where did some of those things come from? So, you know, we're trying to study and understand this in order to inform this period of negotiation going forward. So let's get into some of the details. The nation-building process, of course, leading up to the Second World War, can be defined in a lot of ways, but not an appropriate term is to view the rural and remote landscape as a resource bank. It was a place to go get resources. It was quite chaotic in terms of what that looked like. It may have actually been highly entrepreneurial, but the state and the provinces were not necessarily capturing a tremendous amount of the wealth or rent from that resource material. So as a byproduct of that, there was not a particularly robust period of reinvestment in the rural and remote landscape. And this is a fairly common theme with significant variability, obviously. Ontario would have been much more advanced in terms of the infrastructure that would have been in place. But nevertheless, this sort of theme of a lack of reinvestment and the discoordinated way in which a lot of that resource and remote planning was taking place. Interestingly, I think what I've just described is a lot of what we've heard about what people are experiencing right now, which made me think, you know, the title of the paper could be Here We Go Again, right? That what this is leading to is tremendous amounts of variability and uneven development across the rural landscape, which actually precipitated the regionalist response that we saw in this interventionist period that followed. So I'll come back to that theme a little bit later. So following World War II, and you can sort of understand the cataclysm of that event, a belief both in science and the ability of governments to mobilize massive resources to solve problems. And that mindset and that approach drove rural policy and regional expansion across the country. It was a period of tremendous investment across the rural and remote landscape. Interestingly, in contrast to the resource bank phenomenon of the pre-war period, this was followed by sort of relatively decently coordinated social and economic investments at the same time, because the industrial landscape largely depended upon more settled communities. We wanted a set labor force. How do you do that? Well, you build communities, you build community centers, you create the mechanisms of social stability that allows families to live in particular places. Palese and others have described this as a period of an equity model informing rural and remote policy, which is that whether you're in northern remote Newfoundland, north of Toronto, or here in Prince George, you should have relatively equitable access to education, healthcare, these types of things. And that was a mindset that was really driving policy development at this period. Because of these factors, and also I think in terms of the processes of urbanization that followed over this 30-year period, it's looked upon, I think, with considerable nostalgia. I know from my own work here in British Columbia, this was BC's great leap forward, where the rural places mattered. 50 cents of every dollar, expressions like that linked to the forest sector. So it's not just the investment, but the extent to which rural and remote areas mattered in the provincial and national discourses at the time. Some of the negative legacies, of course, I don't, you know, that nostalgia and we can learn things in terms of the coordination of how policy took place here. But some of the negative legacies of this period that we're dealing with are, a continuation of the empty lands policy in terms of alienating and marginalizing First Nations people, considerable levels of ecological degradation that impact of ecological services and limited opportunities for diversification, and really entrenching a model of staples dependence of low-value, high-volume resource production in the country. It was very interesting to hear both Conifex and Dunphy Lumber present at this conference, and to see companies that are actively reinvesting, pursuing innovation. But some of the other pieces that I was thinking about as I was listening to those presentations is, one, we're still talking about dimension lumber, and two, where did Conifex have to go to learn about innovative practices and technologies? United States and Northern Europe. So the business class and the business sector in this country, owing to the sheer bounty of natural resource wealth that we have in this country, right? We've built a tremendously wealthy society on the backs of a bounty of natural resources that we haven't really had to do a tremendous amount with. So it's created a very low-capacity, risk-averse business class and culture, and governments which are highly dependent upon the revenues from bulk resource production. And those are the challenges that we're faced, and clearly some of the same issues that the businesses that presented at the conference were also wrestling with. Restructuring, so here we are. This is the early 1980s, recession has happened, where we've ventured off into this more neoliberal policy-inspired world, where fewer government services, cuts in terms of government programming, a severing of some of the bonds that connected rural industry with rural places, both by virtue of the flexibility, and we've heard a lot about fly-in, fly-out labor force and all these types of things over the last couple of days, and also a relaxation of the regulatory commitments that bound industries to certain places. A proliferation of regionalist initiatives right across the country, and with the exception of Quebec, initiatives that lasted for 1, 2, 3 years, and then were closed down. And in talking to the mayor of Prince George following one of the sessions yesterday, he said, you know what, we just haven't been allowed to fail. We haven't been invested enough, long enough, to learn, to get together, to fail, to pick up the pieces, to try again. And that's an interesting lesson going forward, and I'll come back to that in terms of how Quebec has managed this process. Because of that lack of government capacity in the rural regions, it really cut off from good information about what's happening across the rural landscape. So a lot of rural policy lacked a real appreciation for the context and specificities of different rural places, and a sort of a budget mindset within ministries. In 2000, ministerial bonuses were tied to meeting deficit cutting targets at the provincial level here in British Columbia, which just caused even worse fragmentation because people were chopping programs that then hurt health, that then hurt transportation, but their bottom line on their Excel sheet came in on target. So significant challenges in terms of not only from a capacity perspective, but just the mindset of approaching rural development in this era. And then in this final period, the recession has happened. Where are we going, basically? And we've called this negotiation, I think, because rural places are frustrated with the policy legacies of the past 30 years. There may have been all of those sort of myriad of regionalist initiatives may have been built up some capacity for engaging the issue, and what we're seeing is really a return to uneven development. Again, going back to that pre-war phase, of you know, the country being all over the place in terms of delivery of services and access to education, we're now seeing a return to that variability and that uneven development that spurred a lot of the regionalist initiatives that we saw in the 1950s and 1960s. So some places are doing very well under this regime. And Marcusen has this expression, sticky places and slippery spaces. The sticky places, to reference Keats' talk from yesterday, are the places that people want to live in, right? They have the amenities, they have the opportunities for you know, programming for your kids, they have opportunities for dual-income families, these types of places. And the slippery spaces are the places that people may be inhabiting because of resource activity, but they're not necessarily willing to stick around. So what happens after that, after the resource is gone, they slide off the map. So we're in a global marketplace that respects, recognizes, and rewards entities and assets. And I think where this is taking us, and you know, learning from this presentation around impact benefit agreements yesterday, is a conversation around resource wealth retention. And I'll come back to that in just a second. So what are the policy implications of this? Well, one of the things that jumped out at me as I was looking at the data is this: the sheer social persistence of rural places. Right? We've sort of been beating them for 30 or 40 years with shifting priorities. I've heard the expression "drive-by funding" in rural areas, and they're still there. Right? There's this incredible, like all, during this period. And this is something maybe that's sort of grown from east to west, is a commitment to the rural lifestyle, a commitment to rural being home. And also, in addition to that, just what happens actually when policymakers pay attention to that social context and overlay policies on some of the social dynamics. And we've learned a lot from the church and state separation in Quebec, and the extent to which some of the religious structures or networks became forums and spaces for having conversations of regionalist policy. And maybe Bill knows a tremendous amount more about that, so he can maybe say something afterwards. Another one is what happens when we view rural and remote places very differently. What happens when we ascribe more values to the rural landscape other than just simply being a resource bank? And Tom's presentation on what does wealth mean is a really, I think, a very good link to this point. Is it about cultural heritage? The national rural policy on rurality in Quebec, I think, is the most advanced national provincial policy that we have here. And are we thinking about culture? Are we thinking about ecological services? To go back to Tom's presentation, are we really recognizing not just sort of the non-metropolitan impact economically and population-wise, but to refer back to Garth's point from the Baxter Report, the extent to which rural wealth is exhibited in the GDP of urban areas, right? And that report was talking about all the financiers, lawyers, accountants, all the office space that exists in Vancouver and counts towards the GDP of Vancouver, but is ultimately dependent upon remote resource wealth in the province. And so when we view rural places as more than a resource bank, what it does is it ends up fostering this investment mentality that we would like to see in how policymakers approach rural places. It's not a cost, it's not a line item on a ministerial budget somewhere that can be slashed down, but a return to an investment mentality about preparing rural and remote places for the next economy in the future. Regional capacity has come up over and over and over again. I mentioned the comment from Mayor Prince George, and you know, I think we can all learn a lot from the regional municipal counties in Quebec, which have been around for decades now, and have the opportunity to go through that learning process, create levels of trust within the region that this wasn't something that was just going to be gone next year after the next election, right? So you fostered a regionalist commitment to participating in the organizations over time, build capacity within them over time, to the extent that you now have a you know, in many respects, a truly co-constructed policy framework of bottom-up and top-down, because the top-down now recognizes these places as significant actors and trusts them to actually have the capacity to implement things. And you know, that's come up in research that we've done here in the Cariboo, where, and you talk to provincial officials, and there's lots of great regional planning going on. You know, groups come together for 2 or 3 years, come up with a plan, and then the province ignores it. And that's extraordinarily frustrating, but then you speak to the provincial actors, they're like, well, we know that if it doesn't work, we're going to wear it, right? So it's them pulling back from really empowering the regions to act on their plans because they're worried about the ricochet effect of failure and getting blamed regardless. So finally, I wanted to... what's the future? What's the conversation in SURF 2040 or 2044 as we look at the next 30 years? The On Your Own is a reference to the closure of the Rural Secretariat. And before this got wiped from the website, thanks to Ryan Gibson, who took a screenshot of it, the announcement at the time from the federal government was, the Rural Secretariat has laid the groundwork for communities to more effectively interact and take advantage of opportunities on their own. So they it's all good. You're good. Just get on with it. Right, you know? We're good. Whew, that was great. So, you know, you're kind of on your own. What that means is there's tremendous amounts of more pressure now on a rural responsibility to organize, for municipalities and town sites within regions to cooperate and work together. If they're feuding with one another, it's just simply inexcusable in this day and age. There's a political catch-22 involved where rural places feel justifiably that they never benefit from government funding anyway. So electing fiscally conservative councils, fiscally conservative MPs, and fiscally conservative federal MPs, and then being surprised when even more services and infrastructure disappears from their communities. So there's political implications here as well. To give you an idea of how early some of the thinking is on this project, and this occurred to me just listening to Tom's presentation, that really I think maybe this next era of negotiation is really defined by this mechanisms for reinvestment question. If we're unable, both locally and provincially and federally, to have an adult conversation about taxation, maybe it's the type of things that Fred was talking about yesterday in terms of rural regions demanding more access and return from the resource wealth that surrounds them. And maybe this is the vehicle for addressing some of the plan, the foundations through which reinvestment can occur. And then finally, moving from sort of the odd anecdote and case study of really good regionalist organizations to structurally significant regionalist organizations, not to belabor the scaling up term, but there's some reality to that in terms of thinking through what these institutions could look like in the future. That's it.